Welcome, listeners, to A Writer's Life. I'm your host, Heike Bohm, the author of the novel Secrets in the Shadows. A Writer's Life is a place where I'll be in conversation with fellow writers. We'll discuss all things writing, they'll read from their latest works, and we'll explore what happens beyond the pen in A Writer's Life. It's gonna be a page-turner. I just know it. Pull up a chair and join us. I'm recording on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Squamish Nation. Welcome, listeners, to another episode of A Writer's Life. Today, I'm in conversation with Tania Bellemeur-Alatte. Her essays and poems have appeared in Best Canadian Essays 2019 and Best Canadian Essays 2015, The New Quarterly, Grain, Event, Prairie Fire, Malahat Review, Subterrane, Carte Blanche, Antagonish Review, Room, The Master's Review, Anthology X, forthcoming, Queen's Quarterly, forthcoming, Syncopation Literary Journal, forthcoming, and the Toronto Star, among other publications. She holds an MA from McGill University and a MFA in creative writing from UBC. Tania's poetry collection, Chaos Theories of Goodness, published with Shoreline Press, will be out this coming spring, 2022. She's the author of Peacekeeper's Daughter, a Middle East memoir. It was published this fall by Thistledown Press 2021 and nominated for the Quebec Writers Federation Mavis Gallant Award for Nonfiction. Peacekeeper's Daughter is available wherever books are sold. Peacekeeper's Daughter is the astonishing story of a French-Canadian military family stationed in Israel and Lebanon in 1982 to 1983. Told from the perspective of a 12-year-old girl, Peacekeeper's Daughter parachutes the reader into the Lebanese Civil War, the Palestinian crisis, and the wave of terrorism, including the bombing of the American embassy that ravaged Beirut at the height of the siege. This novelistic memoir moves from Jerusalem to Tiberias, from the disputed no man's land to the Golden Heights, to Damascus, and on to Beirut by way of Tripoli, crossing borders that remain closed to this day. Welcome, Tania, to A Writer's Life.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to be here.
Where were you born, and what was it like around your dinner table when you were growing up?
So I'm an army brat, and which is dictated a lot of my life. I was born in Germany in 1970. My dad was working there as a Canadian officer with the armed forces. My brother and I were both born there. And then we moved all over Canada on different army bases and eventually to the Middle East.
What were your favorite books you read as a child?
I was a very bookish child and loved to read, especially because of growing up on army bases and moving every couple of years. It was hard to make friends. So I loved as a kid Nancy Drew and then Frances Hodgson Burnett, A Little Princess, A Secret Garden. I loved the Anne of Green Gables series, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, the classics, Swiss Family Robinson. And then into, you know, Tolkien, fantasy. Basically, I read whatever I could get my hands on.
Do you think the kind of books that you read have influenced the way you write?
Oh, absolutely. And actually, I have quite a few epigraphs in my upcoming memoir, Peacekeeper's Daughter. And they're extracts from the books that I was reading that year that I was 12. And so I find that's really interesting because then my narrative is intersecting with those narratives that I was reading and that were firing my imagination.
Who influenced you the most on your journey to becoming a writer?
I actually write about this in the book. I mean, I remember back in grade one, I have vivid memories of learning how to read and the whole world of words, like becoming uncoded for me, of just like a world opening up for me, a huge door. And my mom talks about my passion for books even then, when I was a little girl. And then teachers, you know, throughout my life, especially in my young years, telling me, like, you have a gift. I'm going to see your work in print one day. Yeah, they were just kind of confirming what I already knew in my heart.
Do you keep in touch with any of those teachers? And have you sent them copies of anything that you're writing?
Actually, my grade one teacher tragically died in a house fire. But no, I guess it's part of military life that you move around so much. And in such distances, like from Quebec's North Shore to Yellowknife Northwest Territories, you know, it just, that no, actually I've only met one person from my youth, which was my best friend, Claire, when I was 7. I met her again not long ago when I was at UBC, and she's now living on Vancouver Island. She tracked me down through Facebook, but she's the only friend that I've met since, you know, from my childhood.
On your website, you have always kept journals. What sparked that? And how has that helped you in your writings now?
Yes, I've always kept a journal. I guess it's another manifestation of my love of the written word. And even the idea of chronicling my life, even when my life was very simple, you know, as a child. But I guess the power of the written word to create and to recreate life. And so, yes, I actually have my journal based on that year that I wrote that year that we were in the Middle East. And at one point when I was writing the book, I thought, oh, I'm going to flip through that and it'll be great, you know, research. But really, it was mostly like, oh, I hope that boy kisses me today. I'm so crazy about him. You know, he looked like Tintin with his, you know, his blonde hair. And, you know, it was really like, oh, no, this isn't the research I was hoping it would be.
So do you have a lot of kissing in your book?
I mean, the journal is like it's a glimpse into a 12-year-old's inner life, yeah. You know, yeah. The life of the heart. Even if the city is crumbling around us and there's civil war and there's war with Israel and, you know, and the PLO, but I'm preoccupied with the guy who sits beside me in history class, you know, and that's just.
At a very early age, you moved and lived in many different countries. What impact did that have on you, looking back at it now?
You know, I think it really forced me into the life of the mind, into the inner life, because I was very shy and making friends was really hard. And anyone who's been the new kid at school can understand what I mean. And so I just really turned inward into the life of the imagination and books, as we said earlier, that mm-hmm. were trusted friends and weren't going anywhere. I could take them with me when I left. So moving around really shaped me that way. My brother is the opposite. He's an extrovert and he'd be making friends while the moving truck was still in the driveway, but, not me. I always just wanted that one best friend, you know, someone I could really pour my heart out to, but that takes a while. It takes a while to build that kind of friendship. And so I did manage, but sometimes just the year before it was time to leave, you know, it was challenging.
It must have been hard for your mom as well.
Yeah. The thing with military life is that everywhere we went, there would be a military community. And my father was a senior officer. So for most of my life, he was a major in the armed forces and then later on became a lieutenant colonel after we came back from the Middle East. And so my mom had a certain role or status as an officer's wife. And she would always seek out other French Canadian women. So my cradle language is French. That's what I speak with my mom and dad, and what we spoke wherever we lived. Even if we were like up north, we were the only French speaking family, but we still spoke French together. And my mom would seek out things related to the French language. And I watched her reinvent herself everywhere that we went, which also had a big impact on me. Like she, because whatever, her training wouldn't be recognized from one province to the next, or, you know, or it would have, her licenses would have run out and she'd have to start over again. But that, you know, I saw that you can really shape your life into whatever you want it to be. My mom's very strong that way.
In Lebanon, war broke out on the 6th of June, 1982, when Israel Defense Force, IDF, invaded southern Lebanon. After repeated attacks on counterattacks between the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO, you were 12 and you were present. Can you talk about what that was like for you?
Well, at first, when those events happened that you're describing, we lived in Israel. And so we were quite remote from the war because the war was playing itself out in Lebanon. So we were hearing about it, but though Israel and Lebanon are neighbors, there's no traffic between the two countries. And so it felt very far away. But then my father volunteered to go to Beirut as a peacekeeper, and thinking that my mom and my brother and I would go back to Canada or remain in Israel. And my mom said, no, we're going with you. We followed you far. We're going to keep on following you. Even though it meant we'd be the only Canadian family in Beirut. And at that time, the civil war was also raging in Lebanon. It was in its 8th year of civil war. Mm-hmm. So then when we moved to Beirut, the war became a reality. And we lived in a 100% stress situation all of the time. It was very difficult.
And what was a day like for you in that time?
So in my family, education is really important. And so in Israel, I had been doing correspondence courses with the government of Canada, with the province of Ontario. But then when we moved to Beirut, there was an American school that was adjacent to the American University of Beirut and the American Embassy of Beirut. At that time, they were all one big complex. And so it was quite a prestigious private school with an American education. We learned American geography and memorized the preamble to the Constitution, stuff like that. Read American novelists like Mark Twain. And so I went to school every day. So my brother and I would walk. It would take us about an hour. My dad had made a map, and we were not to deviate from it. We would walk through the war-torn streets till we got to the embassy. And then we would go through a big gate that was guarded. We'd have to show our ID and then we'd be in this gated compound. And so that we would spend, you know, the day there and then an hour walk back. And then once we got back to our apartment, which was in the Muslim sector of West Beirut with a huge bulletproof door, then we never went out. We didn't go out at night. It was too really dangerous with kidnappings, especially foreigners. So we stayed in.
How was your mom during that time? It's so incredibly stressful, and just to keep your children safe. And I can't actually imagine.
I mean, what my mom did two things. She hung out with the other peacekeepers, officers' wives. The Canadian ones especially were quite close friends of hers. And then most of her day was spent actually getting food for us because of the war. It was really hard to get food. She would go to many different places trying to find food. Like, we ate mostly lamb if we were going to eat meat. I remember one time she found a stalk of celery and she was cradling it like a baby. It was a prize that she had come upon this celery. It was five American dollars, but she had splurged on it, and it was a big deal.
And how often would you see your dad during that time?
So my dad worked really, really long hours. He always had like his ham radio, his topographical maps, finding out where the fighting was, because he, as a United Nations peacekeeper, his job was to go to where the hotspots were with his UN Jeep and his flag. And the idea was that then the fighting would stop. It didn't always, though. Mm-hmm. So he would leave like before dawn and often be back like after dark. Because he was the commanding officer, what they call the operations officer. So he was in charge of all of the United Nations officers in Beirut.
Would he share information with you kids?
He would tell us if it was too dangerous to go to school. then he would say, you need to stay home because there might be a skirmish, or, you know, if there had been a car bomb and then we couldn't go through the normal streets that we would, where we would walk. So he would tell us like, oh, you need to stay home today. So he worked very closely with a liaison officer who was also a French Canadian man. And he figures quite a bit in the Beirut section of the book. I call him Ghislain in the book, and he was always attached to his ham radios and would have wires sticking out of his pockets. And he and my dad would be, you know, huddled in conversation in our living room, talking about that kind of thing.
Did you find it difficult to stay focused at your schoolwork? Because for me, I think I would be worried about my dad, and I would just be in fear.
Very stressful. And especially at one point in April, so we arrived in January, on January 1st, 1983. And then in mid-April, the American embassy was bombed, and over 70 people were killed and hundreds injured. And my brother and I, as I said, we were on that campus because our school was adjacent to the embassy. So that was very, very traumatic time. And after that, there was a big tank parked outside the gates of the compound, and there were big American warships in the bay with their cannons pointed at the city. And so that was very alarming for me. I was this very sensitive child, and I actually started cutting myself.
Oh, wow. And,
I just felt very numb. It's how my body and my mind responded to the constant stress, was to feel numb. And so cutting brought like a sharp awareness and a pain that could focus me. So I used my Swiss Army knife. That was a really sad time in my life. I kept it a secret. I think it was also a way that something I could control.
Right. And
I could control it even by not telling my parents. I wanted them to know, but I didn't want them to know. I wanted it to be my secret.
And so your mom was never aware of it?
No, actually, my parents found out just a few months ago when I had a piece published. I think it was the one in the Antigonish Review where I talk about a trip that we took to Cairo, and I talked about the cutting. And yeah, my parents, they were devastated. And the first thing my dad, you know, asked my mom was like, how could you not know? How come you didn't know? But I it was something I could control. So I just wore long sleeves. And
how did your brother cope in that situation, in that fear, constant threat?
So my brother, what happened with him was that when the bomb went off at the American embassy, I was in the library. I was by myself because I had a spare, because my class was learning like beginner French. And so I already was fluent. So I would have a spare in the library. But my brother was in the basement of the school in art class. And his teacher decided to take the class to investigate what had happened. It's very likely that her husband worked at the embassy. And so she took the class. We had very small classes. We were only like about 10, even under 10 kids per grade. And so she took the class, my brother included, and went to the site of the bombing. And so my brother saw mutilated bodies and cars wrapped around telephone poles. And so he had a lot of nightmares and, you know, drew some very grotesque images for a long time after that. The sad part was that at that time, the military didn't have any psychological help, even for soldiers in combat zones. There was no psychological support, especially not for, you know, families. Like the military, the term is dependents, like what, husbands or wives or children of military personnel. There was no support. So we were just meant to kind of, even when we got back to Canada, just kind of find our way, just
right,
put through, you know, in a soldier-like way.
What triggered for you to write this memoir, and how long did it take you?
So it took me really 20 years to write the whole thing. I started right after 9/11. It just kind of came out of me. If you remember, like, how President Bush at that time in America called for a war on terror.
Yeah.
Which really stupefied me. I just knew that that was actually completely impossible to root out terror or terrorism. It's such a complicated thing. So multifaceted. And so I started writing, I wrote a very compressed version of actually what became the book. I compressed it all, believe it or not, into like a few thousand words, which I've since learned is a way to write about trauma, like to just jump in and write very quick, very brief overview, because to dig deep is just too painful. And that piece actually did really well. It went to Grain Magazine and they nominated it for a National Magazine Award. And I was just a fledgling writer. So that encouraged me. I thought, okay, I have a story to tell. And many early readers, you know, said, oh, like, this is novelistic. You basically have a whole book here. You just need to breathe into it. But I didn't have the courage to do that. It was just too painful.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, to remember. And so, but then I was part of a writer's group. And whenever I would write about the Middle East, like, there was a lot of interest and people had questions and wanted to know more. And, you know, and especially when they found out I was only 12. And so I did write little snippets and eventually published, you know, a few standalone essays. And then at one point I applied for a grant, Canada Council grant. And I thought, okay, if I get the grant, then I'm going to write the book. And I had to take a leave of absence from my teaching job. I taught literature at local college and I got the grant. And so then I said, okay, I'm going to take the leave of absence and write. But it was really hard. It was just so painful. So it was a slow, laborious, difficult process. And I had to write other things at the same time just to stay sane. So I wrote a children's novel at the same time.
Hear that actually from quite a few writers. When they're writing on hard subjects, they tend to also write something that's nice and happy, joyful.
Yes.
And it's a good balance, because you do need to do that, I think.
Yeah.
Would you delight us and read an excerpt from Peacekeeper's Daughter?
With pleasure. Thanks for asking. This is it's kind of the middle of the book, and it's a chapter called Beirut Bombing. So it's talking a little bit about what I talked about earlier. It starts with a quote from the Israeli Foreign Minister Yitzhak Shamir from April 1983, where he says, "In Lebanon, nothing is surprising." So this is called Beirut Bombing. In the 3 months since our arrival in Beirut, we'd never gone out after dark. Around 5, soon after the muezzin's call to prayer, the shelling would begin. We always heard it, even when it came from behind the mountains. At dusk, we pulled the heavy drapes across all our apartment windows, as if they could protect us from the terrors of the night. Still, I had to ask, "Mama, there's a Sadie Hawkins dance at school next Friday night." We were washing the supper dishes by candlelight in our apartment kitchen. Blackouts in the city were frequent. "You're not going." She grabbed the frying pan with her gloved hands and leaned her weight into the sink to scrub. "Please, Mama, everyone will be there. Can't you make an exception just this once?" My glasses were steaming up from the boiling water she just added to the sink. The city's septic system had mixed with the fresh water supply, and we needed to add ammonia or bleach to our bathing and washing water. The sharp, aggressive smell of the disinfectant made my eyes water. I turned my back to the sink to escape the odor and wait for my glasses to clear. It was lonely for us, this business of staying inside, respecting the curfew. Our only outing was our daily walk to school and back. The compound that contained the university, embassy, and school was surrounded by a tall iron gate with two guards at the entrance. Each morning, we had to show them our identity cards with the school logo and our picture. Then the guards searched our school bags, even our lunches, and looked at us hard as if we were potential criminals. But once we were inside the gate, the scary-looking guards outside made it feel like a safe place. "What are they looking for?" I'd asked my father at supper time a few days after we'd started at the school. "Explosives," he said, "weapons, information, smuggled goods." "On me?" "You might not be who you say you are," he said, lifting his wine glass. To them, everyone's a suspect. When his connections in the CIA and the Lebanese militia gave him inside information about what he called hotspots in a city where violence was expected to erupt, he kept us home from school. It was his job to discover where the fighting would be and then go there as a United Nations presence to bring peace. But all I could think about was the dance. Ginny said her father can come get us after the dance. The American helicopter pilot? My mother asked. I could sleep over at their place. I held my breath. My mother splashed more boiling water into the sink. I peeked back at her. Beads of sweat dripped down from her forehead into the water. It's not safe. Foreigners get kidnapped at night. All kinds of things could happen. Mama, please, one night, just this once. Everyone's going. My mother paused. She wiped her face with the back of her gloved hand. I know it's been hard for you here. She handed me the gleaming frying pan and reached for a stainless steel pot. I'll call you as soon as we get to Ginny's. She shook her head. What if the phone lines are down? Please, Mama. I have to talk to your father. I can't promise you anything. I'm sorry. Can we at least go to Groovy's? It was a European fashion boutique we'd found when we'd first scouted out the downtown. My mother turned to look at me. In the candlelight, her pupils were enlarged, her face soft. It's my first high school dance, I said. I know. I saw a purple miniskirt in the window last time we were on Hammer Street. On verra, she said. We'll see. The next day was Saturday. We sat across from each other at a small round table in a pastry shop in downtown Beirut. This place reminds me of La Rue Sainte-Catherine in Montreal. Mama smoothed the linen tablecloth. Deux chocolatines, s'il vous plaît, she called to the pastry chef who doubled as waiter. We watched him use silver tongs to extract two croissants from the display case. I love all these old world details, all these gâteries, she said. Apportez-moi votre meilleur thé, she added when he placed the pastries before us. I held the bag from Groovy's in my lap. My mother had agreed to the skirt and even suggested I buy stockings to match. I was relieved and elated that she understood the importance of the outfit, how everything hinged on fitting in. She sipped her tea from a tiny porcelain cup without handles. In the gardens of Sri Lanka, she said, only virgin girls are allowed to harvest the white tea blossoms used to make this tea. They use golden scissors and golden bowls. She held her teacup with both hands in front of her like a sacred object. To this day, they continue the same practices as in the time of the aristocracy, when white tea was reserved for Chinese royalty. Imagine that. She brought her cup to her lips and rested it there. I am drinking what an Oriental empress would drink in the morning in her private chambers. Does that link my destiny with hers somehow? I looked quizzically at her face, then down at the straw sticking out of my Coke can. If the fighting gets worse, are we going home? I asked her. Where is home? She asked, staring into her teacup. Canada. How could she not know that? I had an instant headache. It's a big country. She pressed the fingers of her right hand down onto her plate to pick up the leftover croissant crumbs. We're not going back to Yellowknife, if that's what you mean. She licked her fingers slowly, one at a time. I had never seen her do that in public. We can stay at Grandmama's. Anywhere is better than here, I said, pointing out the window with my chin. An old Mercedes taxi, its passenger door held together with duct tape, honked its horn at a group of men in army fatigues. Their machine guns and ammunition belts bounced against their chests as they ran across the street. The car screeched to a halt to let them pass, then charged forward, muffler roaring. We're staying until your father has finished his work, my mother said into the teacup. My father had told us about daily sniping against Lebanese civilians in Christian East Beirut. The UN presence was meant to stop the fighting. Sometimes it did, my father said, and sometimes it didn't. I had never seen this side of my mother before, vulnerable, unsure of herself. Until now, she'd always been right there alongside my father, ready to follow him on his next adventure. But things were different here. The city was falling down around us. I thought of how my 14-year-old brother had his own passport with his picture and date of birth, but I didn't. My name and photo were fixed to a page in my mother's passport, as if I were an extension of her and not my own person. This practice routinely caused all kinds of complications with Middle Eastern border guards who demanded to know why I didn't have my own documents. In their eyes, I was old enough to be married. In my mother's eyes, I was an appendage, fully dependent. Where she went, I went. She fell apart, so would I. It was a terrifying thought. I sucked on my straw until it made a loud slurping sound. My mother made a face at me and reached for her purse. Let's head back, she said.
That was brilliant.
Thanks.
What was the hardest part about writing your memoir?
The hardest part was giving myself permission to tell the story, to tell my story, because in my family growing up, my dad was the hero of this story. And whenever we would talk about it with relatives, it became almost mythological. It was the height of his career. You know, he was the agent. He was the one who was calling the shots. And we were just following him. To give myself permission to say, well, here's what it meant for me. You know, here's what I experienced. I had to just keep giving myself that permission. And I was quite worried about how my parents would respond, how they would react to what I had written. But they've been very gracious. And I'm writing about things that happened now almost 40 years ago. So the time has helped, just knowing that we're, you know, I'm pretty much a different person in a way. I mean, I'm 50, I'll be 51 soon. And I was 12 when these things happened. So In some ways I'm very, very different. And so is my mom. So is my dad. But it's easier to hide behind fiction, I think, than to face the truth.
Mm-hmm. And kudos for you for having the courage to tell this story. And it's a really important story, because you're talking also about, you know, a child and the trauma with it. And like you said, there was no recognition or help of that. Now that you've written this memoir, how has it changed you, impacted you?
I think it was very cathartic to write it. And I've since done a lot of writing related to it. So I just, I have an essay coming out in Queen's Quarterly in the winter that's called Soldier's Heart. And it's on PTSD and my own journey with PTSD. And so, you know, tunneling in even deeper into the residue of the trauma of having gone through this, but also it was such a defining experience for me. You know, I still carry it with me. And there's the frame of the book is called Carrying War, because I really think of it that way, that I carry it inside me. And what I've learned about trauma is that it lodges deep into the muscles of the body. And so the body remembers, and different things can trigger those memories. But I guess just learning to walk with respect for myself, tenderness for myself, knowing that, you know, when you suffer, it produces compassion.
Mm-hmm.
I think I needed a lot of compassion in for myself. I'm giving myself time.
Do you find that your relationship with your mother and father, once you've written this memoir, changed, that you understand them better?
I realized as I wrote how deeply devoted they are to one another. Mm-hmm. They've been married for more than 50 years. And now, you know, as a mom myself, as a wife, I have 4 children, just thinking about the decisions that my mom made. But she did not want to be separated from my dad. And she knew if we remained in Israel, like there would be no communication, because the countries were at war, and she didn't want that. So I have a deep respect for my parents and, the choices that we've made. I think for a long time I was very angry at them. Mm-hmm. Like most teenagers maybe are angry at their parents. I had a different reason maybe than the typical Canadian teenager, but I've let go of that now, and they've given me a story to tell, and that's what every writer wants, right? So, I mean, I've made it work for me. I've turned it around. And so it's been an empowering thing, you know, to have a voice. And the last chapter of the book is called Let the Child Speak. And giving that 12-year-old who felt muzzled a lot, who felt silenced, as many women do, giving myself a voice was very empowering. And I wish that for every person on the planet to have a voice.
Nice. How has your brother's response been to this memoir?
So my brother is very, very different from me. And so he's been very gracious, as have my parents. And interestingly, he has kind of reproduced the life that we had growing up. So he's been quite nomadic. He lives in France. His children have followed him in all these different places where he has lived because of his career. Whereas I, at the first opportunity, put down roots and stayed in the same place. I've lived in the same place for 20 years now and raised all my children here, and I love it, and I have no plans to move. But my brother is still on the move. But I called him recently as I was editing the book. I wanted his permission to write certain things. And he gave me full permission. He was very, very gracious. Everyone's been so supportive of me and my writing career. They know what it means to me.
That's just wonderful. I know I'm working on a project, and I had to connect with my older sister around it. Her perspective is completely different, and I find it's so incredibly helpful. And now I realize what valuable information she has, what an incredible resource she really is. Did you find that with your brother? Because he's...
Yes. I mean, I take Stephen King's advice very seriously, where he in his book On Writing, he says, yes, write with the door closed.
Yes.
Don't let anyone in to your writing process, your first draft process, because yes, that's very precious and you need to respect it. And it's your story and you're giving it your angle.
Yeah.
And so since I'm writing from memory, I have really, I have done that. Just I get it on the page the way that I remember it. And if it hangs together, I leave it that way. But if there's a gap, if there's something that doesn't make sense, or, you know, something in the timeline that just doesn't, you know, that I can tell I'm missing a piece, then I will consult my family. But for the most part, I've gone it on my own. And I think, you know, traumatic experiences, either we blot them out of our memory,
mm-hmm,
we don't remember a thing about them, or we remember everything in very, very sharp detail. And mm-hmm, that's how it is for me with that year that I was 12. It's like it's tattooed on my heart. And I remember. Maybe because I was journaling, or I just think it was so impactful. It was so defining that I remember.
The kind of research you did for Peacekeeper's Daughters, what was that like for you? Because you had said that you couldn't really look at your journal except for get the perspective of a 12-year-old, but the other type of research, what did that involve?
So I read a lot of memoir, and I wanted to read from different angles of the conflict. So I read, you know, Israeli points of view and then Palestinian points of view. So that was really helpful. And then, you know, did a lot of Google research for, you know, dates and geographical precisions. And I talked to my dad actually quite a bit about the geography of things, of where things were in relation to one another. I love that about working from a computer, is just having like an encyclopedia always at your fingertips. So I'm like that very much as a writer, and my research is always ongoing. So I research and write at the same time. And I would consult my parents for any gaps, things that didn't make sense. But I'm not writing from a political point of view or a partisan point of view, or, you know, I'm really writing my story. What was it like for a 12-year-old in the midst of all of this conflict, both in Israel and in Lebanon? Yeah, I just did it as I went. And then, you know, I would give my first drafts to my friend Michelle, who I know you've also interviewed. She's my critique partner. And so nice. If anything like didn't make sense to her, she would point that out to me. You know, you're losing me here, or I don't know who this faction is. Or so she's a very astute reader, and I basically do whatever she says.
Oh, I love that. It's so true, right? I'm like that with my mentor. Okay. Well, you say it, then it must be so.
I figure she invested the time into my work, so I'm gonna do what she said or what she suggests. Or if she says rewrite, I do it. You know, I don't want to be pigheaded about it.
You also have a book of poetry coming out, Chaos Theories of Goodness, with Shoreline Press. Can you talk about that poetry book a bit?
Yes, with pleasure. So those poems were all written in a short period of time at the very beginning of the pandemic. So from March 2019 until June 2019, remember how we all felt like someone had pulled on the tablecloth of our lives and everything had, you know, spilled off the table and was off kilter. And I had actually been planning a lot of overseas trips for the spring. I was going to Mexico. I was going to do some work with Venezuelan refugees on the Texan-Mexican border. And of course, that fell through. And then I was going to India to visit some friends. And of course, that fell through. All of my children came home from university. And my daughter, who had been in Hawaii, came home. And, you know, everyone's plans were topsy-turvy. And I couldn't write. But I set myself the task of writing one poem a day. I thought, well, I can fill one page. And so I did. I wrote one poem a day, not really intending for those poems to go anywhere except just working through what was in my own heart, the fears in my heart, the questions I had. But so by the end of that season, I had, like quite a few poems. And we have a local publisher here who I had worked with a little bit, collaborating on different projects. And she had read a few of them and just kept asking me to send her all of them, put them together in a collection. And so that's what happened with Chaos Theories of Goodness. And it's coming out in September. So right around the same time as Peacekeeper's Daughter. So a double blessing.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations on that. Would you be so kind and read us a few poems?
Sure, I'd love to. So this one is called Serenade, and you'll remember this from the early days of the pandemic as we were all looking at with horror at what was happening in Europe. Serenade. When I heard about all those Italians serenading each other on their balconies at 6 o'clock every day, dancing and singing with their guitars and accordions, something opened up inside me, like a scented envelope, an embroidered letter that speaks of love, hope, and everything beautiful. Instead of how we might run out of ventilators and toilet paper and the borders might close any day now, planes will stop flying, cafes will shut, markets will crash, people will die, which is scary and true. But other things are also true, like those lovely Italians in the midst of their mourning, making music at twilight, at the time passeggiata serale, that gorgeous evening stroll, with the smells of dinner bubbling on the stove, all that pasta and mozzarella, basil and rosemary and fresh olive oil, those wholesome fats, so good for your heart. When the love your neighbor golden rule comes out of quarantine and takes a breath of fresh air on the balconies of the world. Here's another one. This is called My List of Small Things. That long, hard summer in Mozambique, I kept a journal, my personal book of lamentations, in which I pined for home and garden, something beautiful on which to rest my eyes. Food that wasn't rice and beans and rice laced with tiny stones. At home in Quebec, my friends picnicked and swam, ate blueberries fresh from the bush, savored the long sweet days of July, while I sweltered in my mud hut, cooled my feet in a bucket at night, sent cheerful, reassuring photos to my mother, while mentally scripting my escape each time an airplane flew overhead. At the back of my journal, next to the countdown of days, I kept a list. What love looked like today. It was not brave or daring or impressive. It said simple things like, I washed Priscilla's hair, dug a worm out of Brian's toe, swept the rats out of the kitchen, watched Greta's children while she drank her tea. 8 years have passed since that summer. I'm back in my beloved home, familiar with every tree, and yet trapped in a pandemic, as flummoxed, as helpless as in that endless African season. I've lost my moorings. Quarantined to house and garden, I pour out my bitter lament, try to anchor my reeling, anxious thoughts to the page. At the back of my journal, next to the countdown of days, I start a list. What love looked like today. It is not brave or daring or impressive. It says simple things like, I cut Brian's hair, fed the birds, wrote a poem called My Mother. A list of small things that keep me going, help me find meaning in my days.
Well done.
The early days, when we thought it might all be over by the end of the summer. Little did we know.
Little did we know. So that's coming out in the...
Yes, with Shoreline Press.
What are you working on now?
I have a companion book to Peacekeeper's Daughter, which is called Terrorist Narratives. And it's a series of creative nonfiction, narrative nonfiction. And it basically tells the story of a lot of the minor characters that we meet in Peacekeeper's Daughter, and also coming at the material from other angles, like the PTSD that I talked about earlier. So that I'm getting ready to pitch. I'm still putting that together, Terrorist Narratives. And then I have a novel called Timiskaming that's about a 16-year-old female piano prodigy living in northwestern Quebec in a very remote rural area in 1941. And the challenges that she had to overcome to pursue a life of music, and especially faced with the plans that other people had for her life. And that's very loosely based on my grandma and grandpa. And so that I have that completely written as a first draft, but I'd like to, I want to sort of give it a muscular edit. And eventually my plan is to send it to Thistledown, but it's nowhere near ready for that. And then I'm putting together also another collection of poetry. So I like to work in many different genres at the same time.
That's wonderful. What kind of advice do you have for somebody who wants to start writing?
Don't give up. Just do it. Just go for it. I love what Frances Hodgson Burnett says, that everything's a story. You are a story. I am a story. We all have something to say. For me, writing is really rewriting. You know, it's getting it down on the page, which is amazing. First draft, it's exhilarating. I love the creative process. But then it's working it and reworking it and workshopping it with other writers, with other people whose voices you trust. And then, as I said with Michelle, like doing what they say, you know, like I feel if two of my readers say, you lost me over here, you know, you broke the fictive dream, I came out of the bubble, then I look at it. I try to fix it. I try to change it. And my work goes through dozens of revisions. And I've come to love that. I've come to not resist it, but just surrender to the process and know that it takes time. It's rare that a piece comes out fully formed. You know, most of the time it doesn't. I need to take the scissors to it. But to trust the creative process, like that the piece is going to emerge. It's going to find its form. It's going to find its voice. It's going to find its home. Sometimes it's just a question of time. But keep at it. And love what you're doing. You know, find joy in it. Don't, like I talked about suffering as I, you know, it was a hard story to write. It's true. But finding some kind of joy in the writing. His life is too short otherwise.
It's true. And you're not just your traumas.
That's right. Oh my, that's right.
Tanya, what an amazing story you tell. I'm really excited to read Peacekeeper's Daughter, and thank you for sharing part of your life with us.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm really excited about these books coming out into the world.
That was Tanya Bellaneur talking about her memoir, Peacekeeper's Daughter. For more information on her and her writings, please check the links below. And while you're at it, why not subscribe to A Writer's Life? And if you want more information about myself and my novel Secrets in the Shadows, visit my website at www.heigebohm.ca. For a kinder world, take care of each other.